Good afternoon, everybody. Here we have the front line, as we say. So I'm going to start off with a very sober note. In 2007, we had a turning point for the human race. For the first time in our 175,000 years on this planet, we became Homo urbanus. More people now live in urban areas than rural areas, one of the great turning points in history. But these urban areas have a Janus face. On the one hand, they bring more diverse people together. They extend the central nervous system. They allow us to create more empathic embrace across wider domains. They create a more cosmopolitan sensibility, a more global sensibility. But these same urban civilizations consume vast amounts of the Earth's energy and create more entropy. The paradox of history is the conundrum between increasing empathic consciousness in energy-consuming urban environments and the increasing entropy bill they create. It's no mistake that the most cosmopolitan, the most empathic, the most globally tolerant civilizations are the most urban. The agricultural societies that are not urbanized tend to be the most xenophobic, but they have the least ecological footprint. Yeah, that's the paradox in history. How do we break the shackle between an increasing urban empathic cosmopolitanism and the entropic bill that goes with it? That's what we're going to talk about. Somber note. Last month, the Financial Times ran a small article. It did not register on the radar screen. Perhaps the most important piece of information we've ever had, and we all missed it. Our scientists report that within 30 years from now, we are likely to see open waters in the Arctic across the summer. We haven't seen that reality in millions and millions and millions of years on this little planet. And Homo sapiens, again, have been here only 175,000 years. We're the youngest species on the block. As my wife says, we're not grasping the enormity of this moment. You are. You're the front line. But your fellow citizens are asleep. That's why it's so frustrating for you every day when you get to the office. You see the reality of this and the time we have left. 2 weeks ago, the United Nations FAO met in Rome on an emergency meeting. They now report we have 1 billion people going to bed hungry. That's 1 out of 7 human beings. And our anthropologists tell us never before in history has 1 out of 7 human beings gone to bed without the ability to feed themselves. And if our climate change models are correct, as climate change continues to deteriorate the conditions of the planet, more floods, more droughts, more wildfires, our yields are going to go down, and we could see a collapse of agriculture by 2030 because of climate change. If agriculture collapses, urban civilization goes down. As context, let me introduce an anecdote because I think it's instructive of the challenges we all face in urban civilization. When Chancellor Merkel became Chancellor of Germany the first time around, she asked me to come to Berlin in the first few weeks to help her government address the question, how do we grow the German economy in the 21st century? Interesting question. When I got to Berlin, the first question I asked the Chancellor is, Madam Chancellor, how do we grow the German economy or the EU economy or the global economy in the last stages of a great energy era? This is what we're not talking about, a G20, G7, or G2. We are in the sunset of one of the great energy revolutions in all of history. Coal, oil, natural gas, tar sand, heavy oil, shale, uranium. Is there anyone here in this room, anyone that thinks we're in the sunrise of these energies? Of course not. Sunsets take a while. We're going to be in this very dangerous twilight period for the next several decades. But what is becoming increasingly clear in the business community and in our great cities is that the problems attendant to these conventional energies, are now overwhelming the benefits we get from them. Do we have any engineers here today? Engineers. You know, in the final analysis, we never escape the second law of thermodynamics. We are paying the entropy bill. This is not a metaphor. We took the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age, we dug them up, we created one of the great short-lived civilizations in history. Now that spent CO2, that is entropy. It's clogging the biosphere, and we're not getting enough of the solar radiation back out of the Earth. That's as simple and profound as that. That's the problem. So what do we do? Because it is all about fossil fuels. We grow our food and petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides for the most part. All of the construction materials of our civilization are based on the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age, from cement to plastic. Almost all of our pharmaceutical products are fossil fuel based. Most of the fiber for our clothes and materials are fossil fuel based. Our power, transport, heat, light, logistics, supply chain, it's all built off the burial grounds, the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age. And now in this sunset, this twilight period, we have three crises. They are feeding off each other. They put us in the middle of a perfect storm, and the great cities of the world are here this afternoon to try to figure out how to get through the eye of the storm to calm waters quickly. Crisis number one, the global economic meltdown. Crisis number two, the global energy crisis. Crisis number three, the real-time impacts of climate change on agriculture already in 2009. That's the storm. Crisis one, let me say I disagree with my colleagues, many of them. This is not simply an economic crisis, this meltdown, or a financial crisis, or a credit crisis, or simply a crisis of the deregulation of the market. That's the echo. The earthquake is something different. And unless we understand the difference between the earthquake and the echo, we can't get to a post-carbon era. Here's the earthquake. The second industrial revolution, based on centralized electrification, oil, the introduction of the internal combustion engine, the auto culture, the great interstate highway infrastructures, suburban rollout and construction, travel and tourism, that massive juggernaut, which came together between 1900 and 1929 as a juvenile infrastructure. Then we had a depression and war, and then the mature infrastructure with the interstate, suburban rollout, tourism, it all matured between the 1950s and it peaked in the 1980s in my country, 1988. It peaked in Europe 10 years later. And in 1988, after we overbuilt the suburban rollout from the auto age, we went into a big recession. Some of you older folks remember, a housing and retail commercial recession. How did we get out of that recession in 91? Because that is the key to understanding the economic meltdown today. We didn't have a third industrial revolution in place in 91 to take up the tremendous multiplier effect of the auto age and suburban rollout. So in lieu of a third industrial revolution, and I should say the ICT revolution was boutique. It hadn't found its gate. It's only doing this right now, as we'll talk about later. So in lieu of a third industrial revolution, how did we regrow the economy? We began to live off the savings of 50 years of the second industrial revolution from 1950 to 1988. We built globalization on American purchasing power, and American purchasing power was built on the savings of the productivity and technology of an industrial revolution that had peaked in the late 80s. So we extended a credit card debt so we could move the economy. We began to deplete family savings, so we had purchasing power, and we began to grow globalization. It was all built on a past revolution, not on new technology and productivity. After we maxed out our credit cards, because wages had been stagnant since the auto age peaked in the 80s, then we went to bizarre mortgage instruments with our homes, but it wasn't based on new prosperity, it was based on eating up old savings and going into debt. Then that collapsed. The average family savings rate in my country in 1991 was 9%. For the last 3 years, it was negative, and we have a new term called negative income, which is an oxymoron. We spend more than we make. How bad is it? President Obama's bailout program is $2 trillion. Would you like to know what the total accumulated household debt in the United States is this afternoon? You ready? $14 trillion. We're broke. Unemployment's 10.2%, but even the U.S. Labor Department acknowledges that if you add the marginally attached workers who are only working a couple hours a week now, and then everyone else who gave up looking for work and is not counted, we have 18.2% unemployment, $14 trillion in debt. Does anyone think we're going to come back soon? 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? We are living in an second industrial revolution that's old and senescent. The technologies, the infrastructure, from the internal combustion engine to an old servo mechanical electrical grid to an old suburban rollout, it's all on life support based on energies that are sunsetting. How do we regrow the economy in any way and a dead corpse? Look around Rotterdam and Amsterdam and New York, and I was just in Athens. You can smell this is not new. And don't kid yourself. Go to China and you see the new buildings. That's still the old infrastructure and the old architecture and the old technology by and large. So number one, we have an economic meltdown. It's based on an energy regime that's sunsetting, and all the technology and infrastructure built from it are on life support. Number two, the second assumption of globalization, cheap energy. We can move our capital to cheap labor markets in Asia. Let them make the food, let them make the finished goods, then ship it back because energy is cheap. It's a commodity. Then a curious thing happened. When oil went over 80 a barrel, and keep that number in mind, every day you open up the paper and look to see where oil is. It's now back at 80. That's the key. When oil goes over 80 a barrel, inflation starts to rear up across the entire supply chain and logistics of the planet because everything's made from fossil fuels or moved by fossil fuels. When oil hit $147 a barrel in July of 2008, that was the earthquake. The entire economic engine of globalization turned off. Remember, purchasing power plummeted. Inflation was too high. There were food riots in 30 countries. You couldn't even afford gasoline. And the purchasing power plummeted. The economic engine turned off. That's what I call peak globalization. We now know the outer wall of what we can do based on fossil fuels and the technologies built from them. The echo was 60 days later when the financial and credit market could no longer maintain the pretense of living off an old industrial revolution. And I have to tell you that heads of state, including the ones I advise, have not yet gotten this. A few have, but not in Washington. Not in Washington. The reason we hit peak globalization at $147 a barrel is because of peak oil per capita. Do not confuse this with peak oil production. They're two different things. I know you all know about peak oil production. That's when half the world's oil reserves are used up on the classic Hubbert bell curve in geology. When half the oil is used up, it's over, because once you go on the other side of that bell curve, you can't afford the price. When do we have global peak oil production? There's a controversy, but it's narrowing every year. Back in 2000, the IEA, they were always the optimists until recently, International Energy Agency, said at a 2% growth rate in consumption of oil, this was conservative because China and India weren't in the game yet, we peak around 2035. But in the last 8 or 9 years, the great geologists in the world, using new computer simulation studies, they're looking at the gas and oil reserve figures again, they're factoring in dramatic new oil discoveries that we don't even know about. South Africa, West Africa, South America, the Arctic. They're even factoring in 90% efficiency in getting the remaining oil and gas out. Pretty optimistic. And they're saying, by their studies, we're going to peak between 2010 and 2020. Simmons, you know, the Aramco former consultant, said we peaked last year. As you know, up here in this part of the world, the North Sea's peaked already. Mexico peaks next year. Russia peaks shortly thereafter, so their geopolitical moment for oil and gas is short-lived. I don't know who's right. It's interesting that the IEA is now have a new forecast out saying supply crunch 2014. I don't know who's right. The pessimists, the optimists, it really doesn't make any difference anymore, does it? They're arguing now about 10 or 15 or 20 years. Do we peak between 2010 and 2020? The pessimists? 2020, maybe 2030, the optimist? Short time to rethink the entire energy of civilization, all the materials based on it, and create a new economy. And by the way, as you know, there's plenty of other fossil fuels. Tar sands in Canada, heavy oil in Venezuela, shale, but they're dirtier, they emit more CO2, and we never factored them in to our climate change models. The reason we hit peak globalization, though, last summer is peak oil per capita. That occurred in 1979 at the height of the auto age. If you distributed all the oil reserves that we knew we had then to every human being living at that point, that's the most you could get per person. We found more oil in the last 30 years, but population rose quicker. So you see where I'm going. When China and India made a massive bid to bring one-third of the human race into a second industrial revolution structure, the demand pressure on the oil was so great that after 80 a barrel, inflation goes up. At 147 a barrel, the engine turns off. Now, you notice the economy's regrowing now slightly because we're replenishing inventories. But as soon as we began to do it, oil shot back to 80 a barrel. What I'm telling you, it's a rubber band. Every time we try to get up, we're going to short circuit at 147 and go right back down. This is the reality we have to understand. This is the earthquake. The financial meltdown is the echo. Finally, the real-time impacts of climate change on agriculture. How bad is it? It is much worse, and the public's being told you know how bad it is because you're spending every day on it. I was in Paris with President Chirac in 2007 when the fourth assessment report of the UN panel on climate change was put out in Paris. We had world leaders there, and I have to say, we were all taken aback because we had all gotten it wrong. I'm going to tell you, I got it wrong. My colleagues got it wrong. There may be a few of you very old people who suffered through a book I wrote in 1980 called Entropy. It was the first book on climate change. I have to tell you now, I got it wrong. We all continue to underestimate the acceleration of climate change because we couldn't imagine the feedback loops until after they happened. It's the feedback loops that keep coming back to kick us. How bad is the acceleration? If you look at the 2001 UN report and compare it to 2007, it's terrifying. Because in 2001, we didn't have a lot of the feedbacks in yet. The models showed that our great glaciers on the mountain ranges would disappear sometime in the 22nd century, giving us a little time. 2007 UN climate change report, the glaciers are disappearing in real time across the world from the Alps to the Andes in the first 40 years of this century. And we're going to lose up to 60% of those glaciers by mid-century. This isn't about skiing at Davos. One out of every six human beings relies totally on those glaciers every year for their irrigation, sanitation, and hygiene, everything. How do we repopulate one-sixth of the world's population in 40 years? And that's just the beginning of the feedback loops. The third report in 2007 of the UN said, look to the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf Stream, 22nd century, temperature of the Earth heats, the Gulf Stream heats, more Category 3s, Category 4s, Category 5 hurricanes. The fourth report, 2007, Katrina and Rita, Gustav and Ike, put us in real-time climate change. We've doubled the intensity of hurricanes in 30 years. We're here, 100 years earlier. It's not academic. If you have friends or relatives who live in the United States from Florida to Texas, on the opening day of hurricane season, and from then on, they turn on the Weather Channel every single morning, and they cross their fingers another hurricane is not brewing in the Atlantic. Those four hurricanes alone cost us over $100 billion, and this is just 2009. What about 2010, 2020, 2030? And finally, of course, the third report said, look to the Arctic. Early warning system, 22nd century, maybe ocean waters all open. The fourth report, 2007, the polar bears are drowning now in real time. And we've had open waters in August for 3 years in the Arctic. You can kayak into the Arctic in August. That's just amazing. So how bad is it? The UN report on 2007 says 3 degrees Celsius rise is a middle scenario. Could go higher. Now that's looking optimistic, I'm sure, to folks in this room. But to put this in perspective, if we only go up 3 degrees in the century of you and your children, that takes us back to the temperature on this little planet 3 million years ago in the Pliocene. Different flora and fauna, but here's the most important thing to spread to your friends. It's all about the hydrological cycle. That's what's never explained. It's all about the cycle of water. For every 1 degree Celsius that the planet's temperature rises, the atmosphere absorbs 7% more precipitation and sucks it up from the ground. That means much more violent downbursts of rain, more drought, and longer periods without rain. The entire ecosystems of this biosphere developed over eons of time for a different hydrological cycle. They can't catch up to this. 3 degrees, that's a big change in the water. If we go 2 to 3 degrees, now I advise the European Union, everyone's going to Copenhagen this next week, and we are hoping that the world would mitigate to CO2 so we only go up 2 degrees. And nobody wants to play, including the Obama administration. Understand, I voted for President Obama, but please understand what he and his political party have done. In the U.S. House of Representatives, and this party did it, and he did not say a thing. They passed a bill in the House that would cut global warming emissions by 17% by 2020. And that doesn't sound bad, because the EU is 20% cut. But the U.S. figures are based on 2005 emissions. The EU is based on 1990 emissions. So the real cut in the U.S., under President Obama's leadership, he didn't even argue it out, is a 4% cut in global warming gases by 2020. My friends, that's lower than developing countries. He needs to get off the world stage, or he needs to stand up and be counted. So, if we go 2 to 3 degrees, our UN climate panel report says we risk between, on the low end, 25% of all plant and animal species extinct. On the high end, 70% of all the life on this planet that's so far been assessed extinct, maybe by the end of the century. That's a wipeout. We've only had 5 waves of biological extinction in the last 450 million years in the geological record, 4 wipeouts. Every time we had a mass extinction, it took 10 million years to recover the biodiversity we lost. We're not grasping this. It's maybe too enormous. It's eluding us. It's not even the top 20 issues in American public. The EU is an exception in terms of public opinion. But the EU also is going to have to be the flagship. If the EU is not the flagship, I don't know where it's going to come from. It's about feedback loops. We had permafrost in the 4th assessment report in Siberia, but there were no studies in, so it wasn't in the models. Just to give you one feedback. If you've traveled to Siberia, it's permafrost across the ground in an area the size of France and Germany. And underneath that permafrost is a ticking time bomb. It's the entire carbon deposits of the pre-ice age, because Siberia was a teeming grassland full of animal and plant life. And when the temperature tips on the planet, it tips really quick. There's a tipping point on the biochemistry. For example, between the last ice age and today, 1/3 of all the temperature change we've had occurred in 10 years during the Younger Dryas period. Massive extinction. So in Siberia, that happened too. Tipping point in the temperature, plant and animal life captured under the frost. And now the permafrost is melting, and there's more carbon down there under the ground than in all the tropical rainforests put together in the world, and it's coming up CO2. And at the lake beds, it's coming up methane, which is 22 times more potent than CO2. And the journal Nature a few months ago said in the last 12 months since they reported the ice melt, it's accelerating 6 times faster than 12 months ago. This is just one feedback loop. James Hansen is the chief climatologist for the United States government. He's the head of the NASA Goddard Space Institute. He threw us another curve in Brussels because we were hoping to tell the world mitigated 450 parts carbon per million, and maybe we'll only go up 2 degrees. Then James Hansen and his team went down under the oceans, and they looked at the core samples from the geological record, and they said to Brussels, you've got the figures wrong. You're wrong. If you mitigated 450 parts carbon per million, remember, we haven't even seen 250 parts per million until the industrial age. His numbers show we go up, and listen to this, every parent in this room and every would-be young person is going to be a parent. We go up 6 degrees Celsius in this century, and this is a quote from our chief climatologist, Jim Hansen, the end of human civilization as we've come to know it. I hope he's wrong. I really do hope they're all wrong. Now look at all the younger people here. You'll be here to see this. This is a singular moment in our history. If they're right, and I suspect they're underestimating the speed, we may be determining the fate of our species in the next 3 to 5 decades. That's why all of you are here. You're the front line. You're trying to inform the world and move the world quickly. To do that, we're going to need a few things. First, we're going to need a new economic game plan, a new economic vision that can move quickly into practice. None of that's at Copenhagen. Two, we're going to need a new story for the human race, a new narrative that gets us to global consciousness quick enough to put the new plan in place. Three, everyone's going to have to be on the same page for 5 generations. Daunting task. We need a new economic game plan. It might be powerful enough to address the enormity of this triple threat. The global economic meltdown, second industrial revolution and life support, traditional energy sunsetting. Global peak globalization at 147 a barrel, the energy crisis, and the real-time impacts now of climate change on agriculture and infrastructure. What do? First, we ask this question. When do the great economic revolutions in history occur? We need a new one, correct? This is what all your sessions have been about in the last 2 days. The first thing to ask in the first session is, how do the great economic revolutions occur in history? They occur when two things happen. First, we humans change the way we organize energy on the Earth, and we have frequently changed our energy regimes. That's number one. Secondly, equally important, we change the way we communicate to manage the new energy revolutions. It is when communication revolutions converge with energy revolutions, when they come together, those are the pivotal points in history. They change the human equation for long periods of time. They change gestalt, as the Germans say. They change temporal spatial footprint. They actually change consciousness and the wiring of the brain. Communication energy revolutions. That's the changes in history. I'll give you an example. Some of you are fortunate to study cultural anthropology at the university. You read about the Sumerians in Mesopotamia. Why do we care about them? They launched civilization in ancient Iraq. They did it by capturing the sun, the energy of the sun in photosynthesis. And the stored grain, barley and wheat, that stored sunlight in the grain was stored energy like fossil fuels. They created the first great hydraulic agricultural civilizations. It was complicated. Before that time, people lived in small pastoral and horticultural units of a couple of hundred people in a village. All of a sudden, they had to indenture thousands of men to build those canals. Think of the logistics of this. That was the first machine, the mega human machine, as Lewis Mumford would say. Then they had to create craft skills to build the dikes and the mechanics of a hydraulic system. They had to set up the royal granaries, the royal roads, and the distribution system for civilization. They had to create urban life. It required a communication revolution to manage the new energy regime for hydraulic agriculture. And they invented cuneiform writing. And what is so interesting is everywhere we had these great hydraulic civilizations invented in the Middle East, the Indus Valley of India, the Yangtze in China, and even Mexico, independently, humans come up with some form of writing to manage hydraulic agriculture. That's amazing. 10,000-year multiplier effect, the agricultural age, and consciousness went from mythological to theological and from animism to monotheism. Changed the world. Stay with me. 19th century. Another convergence of communication and energy. The print press had been around since Gutenberg. The Chinese and Koreans actually had it even earlier. But it didn't have an economic mission for several centuries. It certainly had a social mission, as you know, up here in the Netherlands. For Martin Luther, the print press was like the blogosphere for the young activists today. He started mass producing those Bibles in vernacular. And he said to his fellow Christians, you stand alone with your God, you, your Bible, the Lord. You don't need the Vatican or the priesthood. There was a Protestant Reformation. There was a Counter-Reformation. There was a 30-year war and a Peace of Westphalia. That was all social. The economic impact of the print press didn't become clear until James Watt patented the steam engine and we went to coal and steam power. In 1820s, they introduced steam technology into print. It was no longer hand-done. They put in rotary and linotype presses. They could mass-produce print really cheap. Then, around the same time, in 1830 and 1880, in the United States and Europe, we introduced public schools, mass literacy. We created a generation that was print literate so they could be the workforce to manage coal, steam, and rail, communication and energy. First Industrial Revolution. It would have been impossible to organize the complexity of coal, steam, and rail with codex in the monastery longhand. 20th century, another convergence of communication and energy, the Second Industrial Revolution. First generation communication electricity, the telegraph, more importantly, the telephone, became the management tool, and cinema, then radio and TV, the marketing communication tools to manage oil, the internal combustion engine, the interstates, suburban rollout, travel and tourism, the Second Industrial Age. Those energies are sunsetting. The technology and infrastructure based on them are in life support this afternoon. We are on the cusp of a third industrial revolution. And in these parallel sessions, you have been going through all the elements of it for the last 2 days. What I want to do now is structure it in one comprehensive story for a new infrastructure. Although, if we don't look at it as a comprehensive story, you and I are going to be in pilot programs till the earth burns to the end of the game. You understand what I'm saying? What I'm going to lay out to you now is a four-pillar infrastructure for a third industrial revolution. We are on the verge of a new connection, convergence between communication and energy, which could give us a new revolution to get us to a post-carbon era. Maybe, I don't know. I think we can do it. We had a powerful communication revolution in the last 15 years. Personal computer and the internet, and satellite, wireless, and Wi-Fi connection. What is so interesting about this second generation electricity communication, it's different than the first generation that I grew up on. That was centralized, top down. The new communication electricity, everyone here under 40, is open source, it's flat, it's peer-to-peer, it's global. Any one of you can take a $100 device in your hand, create your own video, audio, and text, store it in digital, and then share it peer-to-peer to 2 billion people at the speed of light with more power than the BBC. And if we could do that in 15 years, tell me we won't be able to do the following and create a third industrial revolution. Here's what's happening. The key word I want you to take back to your cities that may get us through to a post-carbon era is this word. Distributed, distributed, distributed. The second generation communication electricity, it's not centralized. It's distributed. Think file sharing. We used to call it cheating. File sharing. YouTube, Wikipedia, Linux, Google, distributed communication. This distributed ICT revolution we've been grafting onto a second industrial revolution infrastructure based on centralized energy so we never got its full productivity because it's basically a distributed communication form. So what I want to suggest to you is that this distributed communication revolution is now converging with a new energy regime, distributed energy. And when distributed information and communication organizes distributed energy, we have a powerful third industrial revolution that starts in our great cities, moves out to our regions, and then captures the attention of the world. What are distributed energies? We compare them to elite energies. Elite energies are simply elite because when you go home after this conference, I'm really willing to bet you that you don't have coal, oil, gas, or uranium in your backyard. They're elite because they're only found in certain parts of the world. They require huge military investments to secure them, huge geopolitical investments to manage them, and massive capital flows to organize them. Coal, oil, gas, uranium are the most centralized energies in all of human history. And I don't have to remind you here in the Netherlands how many millions and millions of human beings have died in wars in the first and second industrial revolution to secure coal, oil, gas, and uranium. Those are the dark undersides of a great civilization. What are distributed energies? Go home, you got it all in your backyard. You all know this because you're having a session on it. The sun shines all over the world every day. The wind blows across this planet every single day. Everywhere we walk, there's a hot core, geothermal core of heat under this earth. Wherever there's water, we have the possibility of hydroelectricity. In the rural areas, we've got agriculture and forestry waste ready to be converted. We all have our waste stream that can be converted back to energy. If we live on the coastal areas where most of our urban population does, those tides are coming in every single day. We call these distributed energies because they're found in some proportion in every square inch of the ocean and land of this earth, bathed by the sun. The European Union in 2007 committed itself to the four pillars of the third industrial revolution. The European Parliament passed an historic declaration, and now it's being implemented, not fast enough, by the Commission. Where it's really going to be implemented is in the cities in this room. You know this, and I know that. The federal governments and Brussels can set up codes, standards, regulations, and incentives, but on the ground, it's going to happen in the urban areas and span out. What are the four pillars? Pillar one, the EU's committed to 20% renewable energy by 2020. It's 2020 in 2020, as you know. 20% global reduction of gases, 20% increase in energy efficiency. That's essential. We can't get to a third industrial revolution unless we do those two 20s. You have to get the efficiencies better and the thermodynamics down and the global warming reduced. But that is essential, but not sufficient, because we're still in fossil fuels. Essential, not sufficient. It's the start of the new game. It's the end of the old one. The third 20 is the revolution. 20% renewable energies, a third of the electricity of Europe renewable by 2020, 500 million people from the Irish Sea to the doorsteps of Russia, done deal. Pillar one. But then we face the problem in Brussels, pillar two. How do we collect this energy? The first thought, well, let's find out where all the sun is. Italy, Greece, I was there last night. Italy, Greece, the Mediterranean. Build those big, huge, centralized solar parks. Ship it on high-voltage smart lines across Europe. The wind, let's go to Ireland. Get all those wind farms off the coast. Put a little voltage thing under the channel and send it out to Europe. You with me? I don't oppose centralized solar and wind. They're essential but not sufficient. They're transitional. They're not the new game. They're old thinking. We have to have them, but they're not the new thinking. They're based on the old thinking because the old energies were centralized. They're only found in certain places, so you go there and organize and then send them along their merry way. But here's the point. If renewable energies are distributed and they're found in every square inch of this planet, why would we only collect them in a few central points? So I want us to think pillar two. Buildings, buildings, buildings. The number one cause of climate change, buildings. They use a third of the energy, a third of the CO2. The number three cause of climate change, worldwide transport. Does anyone know, by the way, what the number two cause of climate change is? A little bit more specific. Cows. Beef production and consumption. I wrote a book on this called Beyond Beef in 1991. It was pilloried by the ranchers and cattle industry in the U.S. They even stopped my book tour for security reasons. They said that's absurd. Number two, we now know this. Number two cause is beef production and consumption, yet not one government leader in 192 countries has made one single statement on the number two cause of climate change. Even Al Gore, until last week, refused to talk about it. And then he was caught on a television interview. If we can't even talk about the number two cause of climate change because we're worried about it may be somehow uncomfortable, how are we going to address this? But the number one cause, buildings. Buildings are this problem, buildings are the solution. By the way, I should say, President Obama, you would be aghast if President Obama got in a Hummer and used it for a family recreation car, correct? Every Friday, he goes to his favorite hamburger joint with Vice President Biden, and they have photo ops while they eat these big hamburgers. Either he doesn't understand or doesn't know or doesn't care. Either way, we got a problem here. And your leaders in your countries are no different. Buildings. I want you to imagine that every single building in your city, every single building in this world that exists right now, current stock, every home, every factory, every technology park, every rural and urban building right now converted to a partial power plant within 25 years to jumpstart a massive global construction revolution based on new materials and design for renovation. The existing buildings. So let's say you have a home, you put a little solar roof, 10% of your electricity you get. You put vertical wind on your office, you get 20%. You put a heat pump under your technology park, you get 30%. Every building can become partial power plant. General Motors in Spain has the largest Opel factory in the world. It's in Zaragoza. It produces a lot of cars. Last fall, they leased that little roof, pretty big roof, to Veolia, the French waste management company. 45 days later, they had slapped an entire photovoltaic power plant on that roof. $78 million. Payback 9 years. The S-curve tells us that if we did it 3 years from now, the payback would be 4 years. That roof produces 10 megawatts. That's enough electricity right now to power 4,700 homes on one roof. You know how much roof space there is in the great urban, suburban sprawls of this world? We haven't even begun. And they did this on their own. In Spain, stay in Spain, in Aragon, Spain, there's a technology park called the Walker Technology Park. It's nestled in the Pyrenees. It has 21st century buildings. It looks like a sci-fi movie. Microsoft is in the park, many, many companies. They have wind turbines across the Pyrenees providing power. They get the snowdrift for hydroelectricity. They have solar collectors across the entire valley following the sun, and they're 80% off-grid. In June of this year, they'll be 100% off-grid. By the end of the year, positive power back to the grid, no help from Madrid or Brussels. Why can't that be done in every factory and technology park in the world? Tomorrow morning. They didn't get any help. Olivia Bouygues sat me down last year in Paris, the great construction company, showed me a drop-dead office complex in the Paris suburbs. It's going up right now. It's so architecturally sophisticated, it collects more sun than it needs, sends power back to the grid. Spain is leading in the positive power buildings, Acciona. So we want to go to renewable energies. Pillar one, 20% renewables, a third of the electricity. Pillar two, we're going to convert the building stock to partial power plants. New buildings, positive power. Jumpstart the economy. Millions of jobs, because we have to convert the entire infrastructure of every urban area in the world. Then pillar three, we ran into a problem in Brussels. How do we store the energy? Because the wind isn't always blowing and the sun isn't always shining and the water tables can be down. These are intermittent energies. You know you're struggling with this right now, correct? Storage. So when Romano Prodi was president of the commission, we sat down and I said, Romano, this was 2003. I said, we got a little problem. If we wake up in 2020 and we know we're going to have a third of the electricity of Europe renewables, I need your help. I said, Romano, let me paint your little picture here. 2020, hot summer, bad luck. The cloud covers out over Europe for 2 weeks, no sun. Really bad luck, the wind stops blowing right at the same time. Super bad luck, the water tables are down on hydro because of climate change, drought. And I turned to Romano and I said, what do we do? And as if you know him, he's a very understated, magnificent gentleman. He simply looked at me and he said, that's an interesting point. Didn't hear from him for 2 months. Then he introduced a 2 billion euro R&D for hydrogen. We're going to use all sorts of storage technologies, flywheels, batteries, capacitors, water pumping up here in Scandinavia. I'm for all of them. Hydrogen is a universal storage, however, because it's like digital and media. It's completely convertible. It's the basic element of the universe. It's not a primary energy. It carries other energy. And when you use it, the byproducts are water and heat. Our astronauts have been circling this planet for 30 years in those spaceships, and let me tell you, they're not powered by internal combustion engines. They're powered by high-tech hydrogen fuel cells. So this technology is not 100 years in the future, it's 30 years ago. Bring it back to every urban area, put hydrogen storage across every building and across the utility infrastructure. So you put a little solar on your factory roof, or a little wind, vertical wind. If you have a little excess electricity you don't need, electrolyze water, high school chemistry. You sat in this class, you don't even know this class, you didn't take chemistry. You slept, like me. You put the anode and the cathode in the water. Okay, and the electricity comes out, I'm sorry, the hydrogen comes out, put it in a cell. When the solar is not on this gentleman's roof, you convert the hydrogen back to electricity. Now don't come up afterwards and say, isn't that a thermodynamic loss? Where are my engineers? You know that every time you convert energy, you lose energy. It's the second law of thermodynamics. You never break even, you always lose. And if you knew the actual thermodynamic loss in converting oil, coal, gas, and uranium, it's through the roof. We just committed 8 billion euros to a public-private rollout of hydrogen across Europe. I spent some time with Chancellor Merkel in 2003. I said, we've got to go with this. She put in $500 million, and they just introduced a hydrogen infrastructure across Germany for 2014. Germany always seems to be right up there in front, way ahead, way ahead. So then we go to Pillar 4. This is where the communication revolution converges with the energy revolution to create a third industrial revolution for our great urban cities and then flagship out. We take the same technology that created the internet. It's identical. We take the power and transmission lines of the great urban areas and we turn them into intergrids that act exactly like the internet. So that when millions and millions and millions of buildings across regions and continents are producing just a little bit of their own electricity, if they don't need some of the surplus, they store it in hydrogen like we store digital and media, and if the price is right, they share it across entire continents. Just like we take information, store it in digital, and share it across intergrid, internets, intergrids. This is power to the people. And it plugs in with transport and logistics, because in 2014, hybrid electric cars, trucks, and buses are coming out, electric and fuel cell, both. Mass production, big six auto companies, fuel cell electric cars, done deal. So now the utility companies are setting up deals with the car companies to put in power charges across all the countries so that you power up in your buildings, and then wherever you are and you park, you can get electricity from the grid or take it back from the grid. The grid itself is connected to software and sensors. So first of all, we got to make it digital. That's a huge infrastructure shift. It's all servo-mechanical. Enel in Italy has now put in advanced meters across Italy in 1 year, so that you can have a digital meter and know how to send energy both ways, to the grid, from the grid. The grid itself, we have the first ones that are going up, first cities, just starting in the last 6 months. We connect all the software to appliances. So across Europe, we'll know what every washing machine's doing. So if there's too much demand, not enough supply of electricity, we can say to 2 million washing machines, forget the extra rinse cycle. If you bought the software for that program, you get a credit or a check from the utility company because you're a player. Dynamic pricing is going to be on the grid. You know, the price of electricity changes moment to moment, and if you knew it, you'd go ballistic. That's exactly what happened when the first grids went up in Washington State with IBM. You could see the price change, and people became obsessive compulsive. They'd say, oh my God, the price is going up. Turn off the damn TV. No TV. Get off the TV. No TV. Okay, turn on the washing machine. They didn't need Greenpeace. They saw the dial. The energy savings are through the roof. This is distributed capitalism. This is a lateral shift in capitalism. Everyone becomes a player. And for everyone under the age of 40 here, this makes common sense. You grew up in file sharing and you... In Wikipedia and Linux and open commons and collaborative social spaces. And I have to say, this is a generational shift, not a political shift. This is whether you think patriarchal and centralized and top-down, or whether you think distributed, collaborative, and peer-to-peer. This is purely it. In the cities where we're beginning to do this, and I'll mention this in a minute, we have some center-right regimes and some center-left regimes. It is all about a generational shift. On the internet, young people don't say, I'm center-right or center-left. They're either into collaborative spaces or they're not. They're into shared commons or they're not. The music companies didn't see file sharing coming. Then they tried to legislate against it. But apparently millions of kids have nothing else to do after school, little kids, but find new software to get it for free. You can't beat millions of little Lilliputians. That's all they're doing all day long. So the music companies went down. File sharing won. Encyclopedia lacked of Wikipedia. Why would people be in an open commons? It's a tragedy, the commons. No one will work together. No one's laughing at Wikipedia today. And Bill Gates thought that Linux were some hippies from Scandinavia. Oh my God, people collaborating and helping each other on open source code, that will fail. Linux is a world player. What I'm saying is we can now take this idea and these business models to power, the transmission lines, and the cities will rethink this economic models for the rest of society. The reason we can do this now is something called grid IT. For 30 years, we couldn't answer the question. Governments would say, Mr. Rifkin, how the hell are we going to run a global economy on windmills and solar roofs and garbage? Let's get real here. We like them. They'll have a part in the mix, but they're soft. You can't run a global economy on these soft energies. You need coal, oil, gas, uranium, tar sand, heavy oil, shale, uranium. We can now answer the question, so you spread this back to your cities. It's called grid IT. We've had it for 7 years. Thank God for the second generation IT revolution. We can now connect hundreds of thousands or millions and millions of little desktop computers with software. When we connect them, the distributed computing power exceeds anything you can ever imagine with centralized supercomputers. We can take grid IT now to the power lines in our great cities. If millions and millions and millions of buildings are producing just a little bit of their own energy, storing it with hydrogen like we store it with digital media, and then sharing some that they don't need at different times, the distributed power run by distributed IT on those transmission lines, that power exceeds anything you could ever, ever imagine with centralized coal and nuclear-fired power plants. This is a generational shift. Those of us who grew up with centralized top-down believe that's the way you create power. We have a new technology revolution, a generation that believes it's collaborative, open source, and distributed. The real beneficiaries of this revolution will be the developing world. We need to remember, with all the talk of globalization, 25% of our fellow human beings have never, ever, ever had electricity. And another 30% have occasional access. It's not dependable. And if we couldn't get it to them at $3 a barrel, we're not going to get it to them at $80 a barrel. We need to ripen these technologies in the developed countries quickly, and then a massive financial transfer, not what they're talking about in Copenhagen, $100 billion, please. We need trillions and trillions done smart with public-private investment, with open partnership between the developed and the developing worlds quickly overnight. The real beneficiaries of the carbon deposits of the Jurassic Age are the Northern Hemisphere nations. The first victims of climate change, as you know, are south of the equator. There should be solar roofs and vertical wind and heat pumps and recycling garbage and ocean waste everywhere. Then we can have re-globalization from the bottom up. Then energy can be local and no one has to rely on the geopolitics of OPEC or somewhere else. Then we create a more peaceful planet. It's power to the people. Let me say, in the last few minutes, I want to completely change focus here. I think this is a decent game plan. This can be put together. Let me explain how we're doing it. We founded an organization last year. It's a network that I chair. It's called the Third Industrial Revolution Global CEO Business Roundtable. It's 100 CEOs of the major European and American companies and cooperatives together. Companies and cooperatives, the major CEOs, in all four pillars, the major renewable energy companies, pillar one, the major big construction and real estate companies in both sides of the Atlantic, pillar two, three, the major storage technology companies, four, the major IT companies like IBM and Siemens and Kima up here, Pirnabers, Rudy Provost is on our group from Phillips Lighting up here, the head of Phillips, and we have the utility companies like Essent and NTR, et cetera, et cetera. What we are doing now is we've realized no more pilots, no more sectioning off. We got to get around that bureaucracy, and we've got to lay down all four pillars in every major urban area simultaneously with a well-thought-out plan. And here's the difficulty. The old system on life support, we can't let it collapse. But we've got to find a way to keep it on life support but move our vested interest in laying out a new infrastructure with a completely new business model at the same time. So our global team is now working with cities and regions and now the first big national governments collaboratively. This only works in cities and regions that have well-developed expertise because their best experts come together with our global experts and we lay down a collaborative master plan. We just did San Antonio, the seventh largest U.S. city, $800 million a year in economic development. That's only 5% of their development funds, a staged-in transition in 20 years. We just finished Monaco for Prince Albert. And tonight, I go to Rome this afternoon, and this week, the great city of Rome, we're bringing all the business leaders together tonight, the political leaders, and over the next 4 days, our global team and the Italy's global best team in Rome, every major department, transport, urban, logistics, housing, everything, we're going to lay down a master plan collaboratively and on March 1st introduce a 30-year plan for the transition of Rome. This can be done in every single metropolitan region. It requires that each region here be up to speed. You are all the flagship regions. You have enough expertise already to do this. Then it requires collaborating and sharing best practices and customizing and helping each other. This is a collaborative venture. Then we have to lay down these infrastructures, and each time you lay one, then you become the experts and go to other regions and help them. Do you follow me? So it isn't just a few of us, because everyone has to help everyone else to get there in time. So if Rotterdam or Amsterdam or Utrecht is moving and gets that four-pillar infrastructure in place, then your job is to go and make sure your expertise is shared with the other regions. Does this make sense? This is way beyond Copenhagen. This turns despair to hope, and we create an economic plan. But here's what I want to say to you. I really don't think we're going to get there even with this plan by itself. I think this plan is common sense. This isn't rocket science. We know we have to go to renewables. The buildings will collect them. We're going to store them with various storage technologies, mostly hydrogen. We're going to put in smart grids and plug-in transport. But there has to be some other change. Unless we change human consciousness quickly, we can't get there. We have to go from denial to acceptance, and then we have to go from geopolitics to biosphere awareness overnight in one generation that separates you from your kids. We have to think as Homo sapiens. We can never be focused on the same page to get through this door unless we think as a single human race. You say to me, how do we do this? What's interesting is when communication and energy revolutions converge in history, they actually change consciousness. It's a built-in little goodie. Every forager-hunter society, that was their energy regime, foraging, hunting, had oral communication, and their consciousness, based on their communication, was always mythological. We've never seen a forager-hunter society that still exists that didn't have mythological consciousness. When we went to the great hydraulic civilizations and writing, we created the great monotheistic religions, the people of the book, the Abrahamic religions, and then Confucianism in the East. When we went to the first industrial revolution and print literacy, the brain was wired again for ideological consciousness, sense and sensibility, rationalism and romantic response. When we went to the electricity revolution, the second industrial revolution, we went to psychological consciousness in the 20th century. My great-grandparents and grandparents couldn't think therapeutically at all. Everyone in this room understands how to analyze their feeling in relation to everyone else's. We couldn't have done that without the electricity revolution as metaphor. Our kids now and the young people in this room and the millennial generation, with the third industrial revolution, you're beginning to stretch the technology so the central nervous system is connected to the whole world. This means it is now possible to create biosphere consciousness. The revolution in the last 10 years, check it out in the grade schools. Your 12-year-old comes home from school and she says, Mom, We got to turn off the electricity when we're not using it. Why? Because the more electricity we use, the more CO2 goes up there, and a farmer in Africa is then experiences drought from the CO2 and can't feed their family, correct? That's a sea change in consciousness. Knowing that our behavior affects everyone else in a single species and our fellow creatures, that's happened in less than 20 years. It's happened in 10. So we have to think globally. We have to think consciously. Now, let me give you what I think the hope is. Here's the despair. The reason we are having a problem, and all of you are frustrated because you're leading this and no one seems to be following you yet, and you're knocking on the door every day, even in your own administrations. I know what's going on. And you're trying to get a little bit more time, and you're in pilot projects, and you're tearing your hair out. If it all depends on what we think human nature is about, and what the human journey is about. You know, for 1,700 years, we believed that little babies are born evil and depraved and full of sin. We did. So a lot of people still do. In the Enlightenment, when we went to the market economy and the nation state, our Enlightenment philosophers changed the game. And John Locke said, no, you're born tabula rasa, except, little compromise, for the propensity to acquire property. That's kind of built in. He made a compromise. Adam Smith said we're born to pursue our material self-interest in the market. That's classical economic theory. Still teach it at the Wharton School. And then Jeremy Bentham tempered it by saying we're born for utility. We seek pleasure over pain. Charles Darwin said we're born simply to reproduce ourselves. And Freud, the most pathological of the group, he said that little baby's born full of erotic desire that needs to be extinguished. It's all libido. Now, how many parents are in this room? Parents. When that little baby's looking at you, are they saying, how do I pursue my self-interest, my pleasure, my libido? Is that what they're saying to you? Let me tell you about a little experiment that'll give you hope. Back in the 1990s in Italy, there was a teeny little laboratory, and they were studying macaque monkeys, and they had MRIs on the monkey. So one monkey, they're watching how the hand movements try to open up a nut. And the monkey's getting frustrated trying to open the nut, and certain neurons light up in the brain. Nothing much going on. By sheer happenstance, a trainer walks in a few minutes later and takes the nut, not knowing, and tries to open it up himself. Same emotions, feelings, and frustrations. The monkey's just looking at him, not moving. But all of a sudden, the same neurons lit up when he was observing the trainer as when he was going through the feelings himself. And they said, "What is this?" It took a few more years. They started putting MRIs on other primates. And they started to see when a primate would see another primate observe their pain or their pleasure or their angst, the same neurons would light up as if they were feeling it themselves. Then they put it on humans and found the same thing. They discovered mirror neurons across the primate kingdom. Now we think the elephants have them because of self-identity, maybe even dogs. We've discovered empathy wired in to social creatures. And every parent knows this. When that little baby's looking up to you, they're looking to belong. They're looking for intimacy. And then around 2 years of old, they explore. They're looking for universality. Intimacy and universality. We seek universal intimacy. That's the awe and angst of the human race. Empathy is a very strange phenomenon. It's what makes civilization. To civilize is to empathize. If I empathize with you, it means I've created enough sense of myself that I know I'm a person. I'm individual from my tribal connection. I feel the angst of my life. I'm going to live and die. I can smell my mortality. And then when I feel your plight, your pain, or your pleasure, I understand you have one time around. This is your life. And I try to root for you and celebrate and feel your pain or pleasure as if it's my own. Because we understand mortality, life and death, and each person's desire to flourish and be, correct? We can do it with a fellow creature. Many of us do it with our companion animals. As civilization becomes more complex, selfhood becomes more differentiated, and we can feel more of an ability to empathize across more diverse kingdoms. The good news, we are extending empathy now to the whole world. This younger generation is connected. When that young college student in Iran, who was a pre-med student, was gunned down after the Iran elections, remember? In 20 minutes on Twitter, an entire generation was in tears because they totally identified with this young girl. So we have the technology now that connects the human race, we can begin to extend this notion of civilization to an empathic civilization. If we have an empathic civilization, we're going to be able to reheal the planet. Because when we extend empathy to all of our fellow human beings and all of our fellow creatures as if they were ourselves, there's no more self-interest, there's only our united interest. We regain our sense of individuality because you can't empathize without being an individual. But we connect ourselves in a more integrated way. Does this make sense? So we need an empathic civilization to move a third industrial revolution. We need to retell the story, and it's the great urban areas that tell the human story. So in these great urban areas, you go back and not only build a third industrial revolution, but help us retell the human journey. Rethink human nature. We are born to be an empathic being. And if we're violent and aggressive and self-interested, it's because the initial attachment didn't connect. And everything else is a substitute. What we really want to do is we want the companionship and sociability of life. The worst thing you can do a person is ostracize them. So we need to build empathy in, and then we need to build a third industrial revolution out. I leave you with this thought. How many took your National Geographic DNA migration test? Pretty interesting. Pretty cool, right? $100, go up on National Geographic. They send you a kit. You take DNA from your cheek. You put it in the kit, send it back to the genetics lab. My wife and I, my in-laws did this. They send you back your results, and based on your genetics, they tell you where you migrated from to the beginning of history. It's wild, right? But what's more interesting, I'm going to save everyone else the $100. You don't mind, right? Apparently, I didn't know this, our geneticists say that at 175,000 years ago in the Rift Valley of Africa, there were 10,000 of our ancestors, men and women, anatomically modern humans, walking the grassland. They located one woman. They called her the mitochondrial DNA Eve. Apparently, her genes passed everyone in the room today. The other ladies didn't. Huh? It gets more weird. Around 70,000 years ago, if I have it right, they found one guy. They call him the Y chromosome Adam, a fairly potent guy. His genes passed everyone in the room. The other guys didn't make it. So guess what? 6.8 billion human beings, we all came from two people, and the Bible got this one completely right. Sometimes the great narratives in history are based on something we don't know about, but it's real. We could have come from hundreds of people, but here's the point. We're sitting there in all of our geopolitical divisiveness. The reason Copenhagen's going to fail, even with any kind of agreement, it's based on geopolitics and division and a concept of human nature based on self-interest and utility and pleasure-seeking. And if that's it, we're doomed. But we have to recapture the essence of what it is to be a social animal. We're wired to be empathic and sociable. We have to create institutions that are compatible. This third industrial revolution gives us a chance to create a new energy regime that's based on responsibility for the biosphere, responsibility for future generations, and responsibility for our fellow creatures because they have a right to be here with us or without us. The mission here with all the great cities in this room, I know you're frustrated, I know you're tired, and I know you're exhausted, and I know Copenhagen is upsetting, correct? On the other hand, the only thing I can say to you is you are the front line. You have to redouble your effort no matter how difficult it is, and got to go back there, and you got to win converts, and we got to take the local city, urban environment, and the civil society, and the business community, and create a seamless family to move this third industrial revolution online and to retell the human story so that our urban centers become the vital center points for a new renaissance, a post-carbon era that can replenish this earth, save it for future generations. Good afternoon.